and we can expect rain on and off for the next 4 days. Some heavy stuff. It'll go on until this slow-moving, low-pressure area slides up north into China, the chief petty officer told them. All of the officers were there. The four flight crews assigned to the mission evaluated this news soberly. Flying a helicopter in heavy weather wasn't exactly fun, and no aviator liked the idea of reduced visibility. But falling rain would also muffle the noise of the aircraft, and reduced visibility worked both ways. The main hazard that concerned them was light anti-aircraft guns. Those were optically aimed, and anything that hindered the ability of the crews to hear and see their aircraft made for safety. Max Winds, a Cobra pilot, asked, "At worst, gusts to 35 or 40 knots. It will be a little bumpy aloft, sir." "Our main search radar is pretty good for weather surveillance. We can steer you around the worst of it," Captain Franks offered. The pilots nodded. "Mr. Clark?" Admiral Greer asked. "Rain sounds good to me. The only way they can spot me on the inbound leg is the bubbles I leave on the surface of the river. Rain'll break that up. It means I can move in daylight if I have to." Kelly paused, knowing that to go on would merely make the final commitment. "Skate ready for me?"
"Whenever we say so," Maxwell answered.
"Then it's a go mission on my end, sir." Kelly could feel his skin go cold. It seemed to contract around his entire body, making him seem smaller somehow. But he'd said it anyway. Eyes turned to Captain Albee, USMC. A vice admiral, two rear admirals, and an up-and-coming CIA field officer now depended on this young Marine to make the final decision. He would take the main force in. His was the ultimate operational responsibility. It seemed very strange indeed to the young captain that Seven Stars needed him to say go, but 25 Marines and perhaps 20 others had their lives riding on his judgment. It was his mission to lead, and it had to be exactly right the first time. He looked over at Kelly and smiled. "Mr. Clark, sir, you be real careful. I think it's time for your swim. This mission is go." There was no exultation. In fact, every man around the chart table looked down at the maps, trying to convert the two-dimensional ink on paper into three-dimensional reality. Then the eyes came up, almost simultaneously, and each pair read all the others. Maxwell spoke first to one of the helicopter crews.
"I guess you'd better get your helo warmed up."
Maxwell turned.
"Captain Franks, would you signal skate?"
Two crisp aye aye sirs answered him, and the men stood erect, stepping back from the chart and their decision. It was a little late for the sober pause, Kelly told himself. He put his fear aside as best he could and started focusing his mind on 20 men. It seemed so strange to risk his life for people he hadn't met, but then risk of life wasn't supposed to be rational. His father had spent a lifetime doing it, and had lost his life in the successful rescue of two children. "If I can take pride in my dad," he told himself, "then I can honor him best in this way." "You can do it, man. You know how." He could feel the determination begin to take over. All the decisions were made. He was committed to action now. Kelly's face took a hard set. Dangers were no longer things to be feared, but to be dealt with, to be overcome. Maxwell saw it. He'd seen the same thing in ready rooms on carriers. Fellow pilots going through the mental preparations necessary before you tossed the dice. And the admiral remembered how it had been for him, the way the muscles tense. How your eyesight suddenly becomes very sharp. First in, last out, just as his mission had often been, flying his F-6F Hellcat to eliminate fighters and then cover the attack aircraft all the way home. "My second son," was what Dutch suddenly told himself, as brave as Sonny and just as smart. But he'd never sent Sonny into danger personally, and Dutch was far older than he'd been at Okinawa. Somehow danger assigned to others was larger and more horrid than that which you assumed for yourself. But it had to be this way, and Maxwell knew that Kelly trusted him, as he in his time had trusted Pete Mitcher. That burden was a heavy one, all the more because he had to see the face he was sending into enemy territory alone.
Kelly caught the look from Maxwell, and his face changed into a knowing grin. "Don't sweat it, sir." He walked out of the compartment to pack up his gear. "You know, Dutch," Admiral Podolsky lit up a cigarette, "we could have used that lad back a few years. I think he would have fit in just fine." It was far more than a few years, but Maxwell knew the truth of the statement. They'd been young warriors once, and now was the time of the new generation. "Kaz, I just hope he's careful." "He will be, just like we were." The sea sled was wheeled out to the flight deck by the men who had prepared it. The helicopter was up and running now, its five-bladed rotor turning in the pre-dawn darkness as Kelly walked through the watertight door. He took a deep breath before striding out. He'd never had an audience like this before. Irvin was there, along with three of the other senior Marine NCOs, and Albie, and the flag officers, and the Ritter guy, seeing him off like he was goddamned Miss America or something. But it was the two Navy chiefs who came up to him. "Batteries are fully charged. Your gear's in the container. It's watertight, so no problems there, sir. The rifle is loaded and chambered in case you need it in a hurry. Safety on. New batteries for all the radios and two sets of spares. If there's anything else to do, I don't know what it is," the chief machinist's mate shouted over the sound of the helicopter engines. "Sounds good to me," Kelly shouted back. "Kick ass, Mr. Clark. See you in a few, and thanks." Kelly shook hands with the two chiefs, then went to see Captain Franks. For comic effect, he stood at attention and saluted. "Permission to leave the ship, sir." Captain Franks returned it. "Permission granted, sir." Then Kelly looked at all the rest. First in, last out. A half-smile and a nod were sufficient gestures for the moment, and at this moment they took their courage from him. The big Sikorsky rescue chopper lifted off a few feet. A crewman attached the sled to the bottom of the helo, and then it headed aft, out of the burble turbulence of Ogden's superstructure, flying off into the darkness without strobes and disappearing in a matter of seconds. USS Skate was an old-fashioned submarine, modified and developed from the first nuclear boat, USS Nautilus. Her hull was shaped almost like that of a real ship rather than a whale, which made her relatively slow underwater, but her twin screws made for greater maneuverability, especially in shallow water. For years, Skate had drawn the duty of inshore intelligence ship, creeping close to the Vietnamese coast and raising whip antennas to snoop on radar and other electronic emissions. She'd also put more than one swimmer on the beach. That included Kelly several years before, though there was not a single member of that crew still aboard to remember his face. He saw her on the surface, a black shape darker than the water that glistened with the waning quarter moon soon to be hidden by clouds. The helicopter pilot, first of all, set the sled on Skate's foredeck, where the sub's crew secured it in place. Then Kelly and his personal gear were lowered by hoist. A minute later, he was in the sub's control room. "Welcome aboard," Commander Silvio Estevez said, anticipating his first swimmer mission. He was not yet through his first year in command. "Thank you, sir. How long to the beach?"
6 hours, more until we scope things out for you.
Coffee? Food?
How about a bed, sir?
Spare bunk in the XO's cabin. We'll see you're not disturbed. Which was a better deal than that accorded the technicians aboard from the National Security Agency. Kelly headed forward to the last real rest he'd have for the next 3 days, if things went according to plan. He was asleep before the submarine dived back under the waters of the South China Sea.
"This is interesting," the major said.
He dropped the translation on the desk of his immediate superior, another major, but this one was on the lieutenant colonel's list.
"I've heard about this place. GRU is running the operation. Trying to, I mean. Our fraternal socialist allies are not cooperating very well. So the Americans know about it at last, eh?"
"Keep reading, Yuri Petrovich," the junior man suggested.
"Indeed."
He looked up.
"Who exactly is this Cassius fellow?"
Yuri had seen the name before, attached to a large quantity of minor information that had come through various sources within the American left. Glazov did the final recruitment only a short time ago. The major explained on for a minute or so.
Well, I'll take it to him, then. I'm surprised Georgi Borisovich isn't running the case personally.
I think he will now, Yuri.
They knew something bad was about to happen. North Vietnam had a multitude of search radars arrayed along its coast. Their main purpose was to provide raid warning for incoming strikes from the aircraft carriers the Americans had sailing on what they called Yankee Station, and the North Vietnamese called something else. Frequently, the search radars were jammed, but not this badly. This time, the jammer was so powerful as to turn the Russian-made screen into a circular mass of pure white. The operators leaned in more closely, looking for particularly bright dots that might denote real targets amid the jamming noise.
"Ship!" a voice called into the operation center. "Ship on the horizon!"
It was yet another case where the human eye outperformed radar. If they were dumb enough to put their radars and guns on hilltops, that wasn't his lookout. The Master Chief Fire Controlman was in Spot 1, the forward fire director tower that made the most graceful part of his ship's profile. His eyes were glued to the eyepieces of the long base rangefinders, designed in the late 1930s, and still as fine a piece of optical gear as America had ever produced. His hand turned a small wheel, which operated not unlike the focusing mechanism of a camera, bringing a split image together. His focus was on the radar antenna, whose metal framework, not protected now with camouflage netting, made a nearly perfect aiming reference.
"Mark!"
The fire controlman second class next to him keyed the microphone, reading the numbers off the dial.
"Range 15250.
In central fire control, 100 feet below Spot 1, mechanical computers accepted the data, telling the cruiser's 8 guns how much to elevate. What happened next was simple enough. Already loaded, the guns rotated with their turrets, coming up to the proper angle of elevation calculated a generation earlier by scores of young women, now grandmothers, on mechanical calculators. On the computer, the cruiser's speed and course were already set. And since they were firing at a stationary target, it was assigned an identical but reversed velocity vector. In this way, the guns would automatically remain locked on target.
"Commence firing," the gunnery officer commanded.
A young sailor closed the firing keys, and USS Newport News shook with the first salvo of the day.
"Okay, on azimuth, we're short by 300, the Master Chief said quietly, watching the fountains of dirt in the 20-power rangefinders.
"Up 300, the talker relayed, and the next salvo thundered off 15 seconds later. He didn't know that the first salvo had inadvertently immolated the command bunker for the radar complex. The second salvo arced through the air.
"This one does it," the Master Chief whispered.
It did. 3 of the 8 rounds landed within 50 yards of the radar antenna and shredded it. "On target," he said over his own microphone, waiting for the dust to clear. "Target destroyed."
"Beats an airplane any day," the captain said, observing from the bridge.
He'd been a young gunnery officer on USS Mississippi 25 years earlier, and had learned shore bombardment against live targets in the Western Pacific, as had his treasured Master Chief in Spot 1. This was sure to be the last hurrah for the Navy's real gunships, and the captain was determined that it would be a loud one. A moment later, some splashes appeared 1,000 yards off. These would be from 130-millimeter long guns the NVA used to annoy the Navy. He would engage them before concentrating on AAA sites.
"Counter battery," the skipper called to Central Fire Control.
"Aye, sir, we're on it." A minute later, Newport News shifted fire, her rapid-fire gun searching for and finding the 6 130s that really should have known better. It was a diversion, the captain knew. It had to be. Something was happening somewhere else. He didn't know what, but it had to be something good to allow him and his cruiser on the gun line north of the DMZ. Not that he minded, the CO said to himself, feeling his ship shudder yet again.
30 seconds later, a rapidly expanding orange cloud announced the demise of that gun battery. "I got secondaries," the CO announced. The bridge crew hooted briefly, then settled back down to work. "There you are." Captain Mason stepped back from the periscope. "Pretty close." Kelly needed only one look to see that Estevez was a cowboy. Skate was scraping off barnacles. The periscope was barely above water, the water lapping at the lower half of the lens. "I suppose that'll do." "Good rainstorm, topside," Estevez said. "Good is right." Kelly finished off his coffee, the real Navy sort with salt thrown in. "I'm going to use it." "Right now?" "Yes, sir." Kelly nodded curtly. "Unless you plan to go in closer," he added with a challenging grin. "Unfortunately, we don't have any wheels on the bottom, or I might just try." Estevez gestured him forward. "What's this one about? I usually know." "Sir, I can't say. Tell you this, though. If it works, you'll find out." That would have to do, and Estevez understood. "Then you better get ready." As warm as the waters were, Kelly still had to worry about the cold. 8 hours in water with only a small temperature differential could sap the energy from his body like a short-circuited battery. He worked his way into a green and black neoprene wetsuit, adding double the normal amount of weight belts. Alone in the executive officer's stateroom, he had his last sober pause, beseeching God to help not himself, but the men whom he was trying to rescue. It seemed a strange thing to pray, Kelly thought, after what he'd done so recently, yet so far away. And he took the time to ask forgiveness for anything wrong he might have done, still wondering if he had transgressed or not. It was a time for that sort of reflection, but only briefly. He had to look forward now. Maybe God would help him to rescue Colonel Zacharias, but he had to do his part, too. Kelly's last thought before leaving the stateroom was of the photo of a lonely American about to be clubbed from behind by some little NVA fuck. It was time to put an end to that, he told himself, opening the door. "Escape trunks this way," Estevez said. Kelly climbed up the ladder, watched by Estevez and perhaps 6 or 7 other men of Skate. "Make sure we find out," the captain said, levering the hatch shut himself. "I'll sure as hell try," Kelly replied, just as the metal fitting locked into place. There was an aqualung waiting for him. The gauge read full, Kelly saw, checking it again himself. He lifted the waterproof phone. "Clark here, in the trunk, ready to go. Sonar reports nothing except heavy rain on the surface. Visual search is negative. Vaya con Dios, Señor Clark." "Gracias," Kelly chuckled his reply. He replaced the phone and opened the flooding valve. Water entered the bottom of the compartment, the air pressure changing suddenly in the cramped space. Kelly checked his watch. It was 8:16 when he cracked the hatch and pulled himself to the submerged foredeck of USS Skate. He used a light to illuminate the sea sled. It was tied down at 4 points, but before loosing it, he clipped a safety line to his belt. It wouldn't do to have the thing motor off without him. The depth gauge read 49 feet. The submarine was in dangerously shallow water, and the sooner he got away, the sooner her crew would be safe again. Unclipping the sled, he flipped the power switch, and 2 shrouded propellers started turning slowly. Good. Kelly pulled the knife from his belt and banged it twice on the deck, then adjusted the flippers on the sled and headed off, on a compass course of 308. There was now no turning back, Kelly told himself. But for him, there rarely was. Chapter 28 First In. It was just as well that he couldn't smell the water. At least, not at first. Few things can be as unnerving or disorienting as swimming underwater at night. Fortunately, the people who'd designed the sled were divers themselves and knew that. The sled was slightly longer than Kelly was tall. It was, in fact, a modified torpedo with attachments allowing a man to steer it and control its speed, essentially making it a mini-submarine, though in appearance it was more like an aircraft drawn by a child. The wings, actually referred to as flippers, were controlled by hand. There was a depth gauge and an up-down angle indicator, along with a battery strength gauge and the vital magnetic compass. The electric motor and batteries had originally been designed to drive the shape through the water at high speed for over 10,000 yards. At lower speeds, it could go much farther. In this case, it had 5 to 6 hour endurance at 5 knots, more if the craftsmen aboard Ogden were right. It was strangely like flying over in the C-141. The whirring of the twin props couldn't be heard any great distance, but Kelly was a mere 6 feet from them. The steady high-speed whine was already making him grimace inside his diving mask. Part of that was all the coffee he'd drunk. He had to stay nervously alert, and he had enough caffeine in him to enliven a corpse. So many things to worry about. There was boat traffic on the river. Whether ferrying AAA ammo from one bank of the river to another, or perhaps the Vietnamese version of a teeny bopper crossing to see his girlfriend, there were small boats here. Running into one could be lethal in one of several ways, differing only in immediacy, not the final outcome. Perversely, visibility was almost nil, and so Kelly had to assume that he'd have no more than 2 or 3 seconds to avoid something. He held to the middle of the channel as best he could. Every 30 minutes he'd slow down and ease his head above the surface for a position fix. There was no activity at all, he could see. This country didn't have much in the way of electrical power stations anymore, and without lights by which to read or perhaps power radios, life for the ordinary people was as primitive as it was brutish for their enemies. It was all vaguely sad. Kelly didn't think that the Vietnamese people were any more innately warlike than any other. But there was a war here, and their behavior, as he had seen, fell short of exemplary. He took his fix and headed down again, careful not to go deeper than 10 feet. He'd heard of a case of a diver who'd died while making an overly rapid ascent after being pressurized for a few hours at 15 feet, and he had no desire at all to relive it himself. Time crept by. Every so often the overhead clouds would thin out, and the light of the quarter moon would give definition to the raindrops on the surface of the river. Fragile black circles expanding and disappearing on the ghostly blue screen 10 feet above his head. Then the clouds would thicken again, and all he'd see was a dark gray roof, and the sound of the falling drops would compete with the infernal whirring of the props. Another danger was hallucination. Kelly had an active mind, and he was now in an environment devoid of input. Worse, his body was being lulled. He was in a nearly weightless state, rather like it must have been in the womb, and the sheer comfort of the experience was dangerous. His mind might react by dreaming, and he couldn't have that. Kelly developed a routine, sweeping his eyes over the rudimentary instruments, playing little games, like trying to hold his craft exactly level without using the angle indicator. But that proved impossible. What pilots called vertigo happened even more quickly here than in the air, and he found that he couldn't manage it for more than 15 or 20 seconds before he started to tilt and go deeper. Every so often he'd do a complete roll just for the difference of it, but mainly he cycled his eyes to the water and back to the instruments, repeating the process again and again, until that also became dangerously monotonous. Only 2 hours into the passage, Kelly had to tell himself to concentrate. But he couldn't concentrate on just one thing, or even two. Comfortable as he was, every human being within a 5-mile radius would wish nothing better than to end his life. Those people lived here, knew the land and the river, knew the sounds and the sights. And theirs was a country at war, where the unusual meant the dangerous and the enemy. Kelly didn't know if the government paid bounty for dead or live Americans, but something like that must have been operating. People worked harder for a reward, especially one that coincided with patriotism. Kelly wondered how it had all happened. Not that it mattered. These people were enemies. Nothing would soon change that. Certainly not in the next 3 days, which was as far as the future went for Kelly. If there were to be anything beyond it, he had to pretend that there was not. His next programmed halt was at a meandering horseshoe bend. Kelly slowed the sled and lifted his head carefully. Noise on the north bank, perhaps 300 yards. It carried across the water. Male voices speaking in the language whose lilt had somehow always sounded poetic to him, but quickly turned ugly when the content was anger. Like the people, he supposed, listening for perhaps 10 seconds. He took the sled back down, watching the course change on the compass as he followed the sweeping bend. What a strange intimacy that had been, if only for a few seconds. What were they talking about? Politics? Boring subject in a communist country. Farming, perhaps. Talk of the war? Perhaps, for the voices were subdued. America was killing enough of this country's young men that they had reason to hate us, Kelly thought, and the loss of a son could be little different here than at home. They might talk to others about their pride for the little boy gone off to be a soldier, fried in napalm, dismembered by a machine gun, or turned to vapor by a bomb. The stories had to come back one way or another, even as lies, which amounted to the same thing. But in every case it must have been a child who'd taken a first step and said Daddy in his native tongue. But some of the same children had grown up to follow Plastic Flower, and he did not regret killing them. The talk he'd heard sounded human enough, even if he couldn't understand it. And then came the casual question. What made them different? They are different, asshole. Let the politicians worry about why. Asking those kinds of questions distracted him from the fact that there were 20 people like Kelly up the river. He swore in his mind and concentrated again on driving the sled. Few things distracted Pastor Charles Meyer from the preparation of his weekly sermons. It was perhaps the most important part of his ministry, telling people what they needed to hear in a clear, concise manner, because his flock saw him only once a week, unless something went wrong. And when something went badly wrong, they needed the foundation of faith already in place if his special attention and counsel were to be truly effective. Meyer had been a minister for 30 years, all of his adult life, and the natural eloquence that was one of his true gifts had been polished by years of practice to the point where he could choose a scripture passage and develop it into a finely focused lesson in morality. The Reverend Meyer was not a stern man. His message of faith was that of mercy and love. He was quick to smile and to joke, and though his sermons were of necessity a serious business, for salvation was the most serious of human goals, it was his task, he thought, to emphasize God's true nature. Love, mercy, charity, redemption. His entire life, Meyer thought, was dedicated to helping people return after a bout of forgetfulness to embrace despite rejection. A task as important as that was worth a diversion of his time. "Welcome back, Doris," Meyer said as he entered Ray Brown's house. A man of medium height, his thick head of gray hair gave him a stately and learned appearance. He took both her hands in his, smiling warmly. "Our prayers are answered." For all his pleasant and supportive demeanor, this would be an awkward meeting for all three participants. Doris had erred, probably rather badly, he thought. Meyer recognized that, trying not to dwell on it in a punitive way. The really important thing was that the prodigal had returned, and if Jesus had spent his time on earth for any reason, that parable contained it all in just a few verses. All of Christianity in a single story. No matter how grave one's misdeeds might be, there would always be a welcome for those with the courage to return. Father and daughter sat together on the old blue sofa, with Meyer to their left in an armchair. 3 cups of tea were on the low table. Tea was the proper drink for a moment like this. "I'm surprised how good you look, Doris." He smiled, concealing his desperate desire to put the girl at ease.
"Thank you, Pastor."
"It's been hard, hasn't it?" Her voice became brittle.
"Yes."
"Doris, we all make mistakes. God made us imperfect. You have to accept that. And you have to try to do better all the time. We don't always succeed. But you did succeed. You're back now. The bad things are behind you, and with a little work, you can leave them behind you forever.
I will, she said with determination. I really will. I've seen and done such awful things.
Meyer was a difficult man to shock. Clergymen were in the profession of listening to stories about the reality of hell, because sinners could not accept forgiveness until they were able to forgive themselves, a task which always required a sympathetic ear and a calm voice of love and reason. But what he heard now did shock him. He tried to freeze his body into place. Above all, he tried to remember that what he heard was indeed behind his afflicted parishioner, as over the course of 20 minutes he learned of things that even he had never dreamed of, things from another time, since his service as a young army chaplain in Europe. There was a devil in creation, something for which his faith had prepared him. But the face of Lucifer was not for unprotected eyes of men, certainly not for the eyes of a young girl whom an angry father had mistakenly driven away at a young and vulnerable age. It only got worse. Prostitution was frightening enough. What damage it did to young women could last a lifetime. And he was grateful to learn that Doris was seeing Dr. Bryant, a wonderfully gifted physician to whom he'd referred two of his flock. For several minutes he shared Doris's pain and shame, while her father bravely held her hand, fighting back his own tears. Then it turned to drugs. First the use of them, then the transfer of them to other evil men. She was honest through it all, trembling, with tears dripping from her eyes, facing a past to make the strongest of hearts quail. Next came the recounting of sexual abuse, and finally, the worst part of all. It became very real to Pastor Meyer. Doris seemed to remember it all, as well she might. It would take all of Dr. Bryant's skills to drive this horror into the past. She told the story in the manner of a motion picture, seemingly leaving nothing out. That was a healthy thing, to put it all in the open in this way. Healthy for Doris, even healthy for her father. But Charles Meyer necessarily became the recipient of the horror that others were attempting to cast away. Lives had been lost. Innocent lives. Victims' lives. Two girls not unlike the one before him, murdered in a way worthy of damnation, the pastor told himself in a voice of sadness mixed with rage.
The kindness you showed to Pam, my dear, that is one of the most courageous things I've ever heard, the pastor said quietly, after it was all over, moved nearly to tears himself. That was God, Doris. That was God acting through your hands and showing you the goodness of your character. You think so? She asked, bursting then into uncontrolled tears.
He had to move then, and he did, kneeling in front of father and daughter, taking their hands in his.
God visited you and saved you, Doris. Your father and I prayed for this moment. You've come back, and you won't ever do things like that again.
Pastor Meyer couldn't know what he hadn't been told, the things that Doris had deliberately left out. He knew that a Baltimore physician and nurse had restored his parishioner to physical health. He didn't know how Doris had come to that point, and Meyer assumed that she'd escaped, as the girl Pam had almost done. Nor did he know that Dr. Bryant had been warned to keep all of this information close. That might not have mattered in any case. There were other girls still in the control of this Billy person and his friend Rick. As he had dedicated his life to denying souls to Lucifer, so also he had a duty to deny their bodies to him. He had to be careful. A conversation like this one was privileged in the ultimate sense. He would counsel Doris to speak with the police, though he could never force her to do so. But as a citizen, as a man of God, he had to do something to help those other girls. Exactly what, he wasn't sure. He'd ask his son about that, a young sergeant with the Pittsburgh City Police Force. There. Kelly's head was above the water only enough to expose his eyes. He reached up with his hands to pull the rubber hood off his head, allowing his ears better access to the sounds of the area. There was all manner of noise. Insects, the flapping of bats, and loudest of all, the rain that was sprinkling lightly at the moment. To his north was darkness that his acclimated eyes began to break into shapes. There was his hilltop, a mile away past another lower hill. He knew from the aerial photographs that there were no habitations between where he was and where he had to go. There was a road only 100 yards away, and at the moment it was totally vacant. So quiet it was that any mechanical sound would surely have reached him. There was none. It was time. Kelly steered the sled close to the bank. He selected a place with overhanging trees for the additional concealment. His first physical contact with the soil of North Vietnam had an electric feel to it. That soon passed. Kelly stripped off the wetsuit, stuffing it in the waterproof container on the now surfaced sled. He quickly donned his camouflage fatigues. The jungle boots had soles copied from the NVAs in case anyone spotted tracks that looked out of the ordinary. Next, he did his camouflage makeup, dark green on forehead and cheekbones and jaw, with lighter colors under his eyes and in the hollow of his cheeks. Shouldering his gear, he flipped the power switch on the sled. It motored off towards the middle of the river, its flotation chambers vented now, sinking it to the bottom. Kelly made an effort not to watch it hum away. It was bad luck, he remembered, to watch the helicopter fly away from the LZ. It showed lack of purpose. Kelly turned to the land, listening again for traffic on the road. Hearing none, he climbed the bank and crossed the gravel path immediately, disappearing at once into the thick foliage, moving slowly and deliberately up the first hill. People cut wood here for cooking fires. That was disturbing. Might people be out cutting tomorrow? But helpful, too, as it allowed him to make his way more quickly and more quietly. He walked in a tense crouch, careful where he placed his feet, his eyes and ears sweeping around constantly as he moved. His carbine was in his hands. His thumb felt the selector switch, in the safe position. A round was chambered. He'd already checked that. The Navy chief had prepared the weapon properly and would understand that Kelly had needed to verify it visually. But if there was any one thing Kelly did not wish to do, it was to fire a single round from his Car 15. Climbing the first hill took half an hour. Kelly stopped there, finding a clear spot from which to look and listen. It was approaching 3 in the morning, local time. The only people awake were those who had to be, and they wouldn't like it very much. The human body was linked to a day-night cycle, and at this time of the morning bodily functions ebbed. Nothing. Kelly moved on, going down the hill. At the bottom was a small stream that fed into the river. He took the opportunity to fill one of his canteens, dropping in a purification tablet as he did so. Again he listened, since sound followed nicely down valleys and over streams. Still nothing. He looked up at his hill, a gray mass under the cloudy sky. The rain was picking up as Kelly started his climb. Fewer trees had been cut here, which made sense, as the road didn't come all that close. This area was a little steep for proper farming, and with good bottomland so close by, he felt he could depend on a minimum of visitors. Probably that's why Sender Green had been placed here, he told himself. There was nothing around to attract serious attention. That would cut both ways. Halfway up, his eyes got their first look at the prison camp. It was an open space amidst forest. He didn't know if the area had started off as a meadow, or if the trees had been cut for one reason or another. A branch of the river road came straight in from the other side of his hill. Kelly saw a flare of light from one of the guard towers. Someone with a cigarette, no doubt. Didn't people ever learn? It could take hours to get your night vision really working, and just that much could ruin it. Kelly looked away, concentrating on the remainder of his climb, moving around bushes, seeking open spots where his uniform wouldn't rub against branches and leaves, making deadly noise. It almost came as a surprise when he reached the top. He sat down for a moment, making himself totally still, looking and listening some more before he began his examination of the camp. He found a very good spot, perhaps 20 feet below the crest. The far side of the hill was steep, and a casual climber would make noise. In this place he wouldn't be skylined to an observer below. His place was within the shroud of bushes to break up whatever outline he might present. This was his place on his hill. He reached in his vest and pulled out one of his radios. "Snake calling Cricket. Over." "Snake, this is Cricket. Reading you 5x5, one of the communicators replied inside the commo van parked on Ogden's deck. "In place. Beginning surveillance. Over." "Copy that. Out." He looked up at Admiral Maxwell. Phase 2 of Boxwood Green was now complete. Phase 3 began at once. Kelly took the Marine 7x50 binoculars from their case and began examining the camp. There were guards in all 4 towers, 2 of them smoking. That had to mean their officer was asleep. The NVA had adamantine discipline and punished transgressions harshly. Death was not an uncommon price for even a minor offense. There was a single automobile present, parked as expected near the building which had to house the officers at this compound. There were no lights at all, and no sounds. Kelly rubbed the rain from his eyes and checked the focus on both eyepieces before he commenced his survey. In a strange way, it was like being back at Quantico Marine Base. The similarity of angle and perspective was uncanny. There seemed to be some minor differences in the buildings, but it could be the dark causing that, or perhaps a slight change in color. No, he realized. It was the courtyard, parade ground, whatever he was supposed to call it. There was no grass there. The surface was flat and bare, just the red clay of this region. The different color and lack of texture gave the buildings a subtly different setting. Different roofing materials, but the same slope. It was like being at Quantico, and with luck, the battle would be as successful as the drills. Kelly settled in, allowing himself a sip of water. It had the distilled tastelessness of what they made on the submarine, clean and foreign, as he was in this alien place. At 3:45, he saw some lights in the barracks, flickering yellow, like candles. Guard change, perhaps. The 2 soldiers in the tower nearest him were stretching, chatting to each other casually. Kelly could barely make out the murmur of conversation, but not the words or cadence. They were bored. This would be that sort of duty. They might grouse about it, but not that badly. The alternative would be a stroll down the Ho Chi Minh Trail through Laos, and, patriotic though they might have been, only a fool would relish that thought. Here they kept watch on 20 or so men, locked in individual cells, perhaps chained to walls or otherwise hobbled, with as much chance of escaping the camp as Kelly had of walking on water. And even if they succeeded in that most impossible of feats, what would they be? 6-foot-tall white men in a land of small yellow people, none of whom would lift a hand on their behalf. Alcatraz Federal Prison could be no more secure than this. So the guards had 3 squares a day and quiet, boring duty that would dull their senses. Good news, Kelly told himself. Stay bored, guys. The barracks doors opened. 8 men came out. No NCO in charge of the detail. That was interesting, surprisingly casual for the NVA. They broke into pairs, each heading for a tower. In each case, the relief crew climbed up before the duty crew came down, which was to be expected. A few remarks were exchanged, and the soldiers going off duty climbed down. 2 lit up before heading back in the barracks, speaking to each other at the entrance. It was, all in all, a comfortable and grossly normal routine conducted by men who'd been doing the same thing for months. Wait. 2 of them limped, Kelly realized. Veterans. That was good news and bad news. People with combat experience were simply different. The time would come for action, and they'd react well, probably. Even without recent training, instincts would kick in, and they'd try to fight back effectively even without leadership. but as veterans they'd also be softer, disdainful of their duty, however cushy it might be, lacking the awkward eagerness of fresh young troops. As with all swords, that one cut in two directions. In either case, the plan of attack allowed for it. Kill people without warning, and their training was a moot point, which made it a hell of a lot safer. Anyway, that was one wrong assumption. Troops on POW guard duty were usually second-raters. These, at least, were combat troops, even if they had sustained wounds that relegated them to backup service. Any other mistakes? Kelly wondered. He couldn't see any yet. His first substantive radio message was a single code group, which he tapped out using Morse code. Easy spot, sir. The communications technicians tapped out an acknowledgement. Good news? Captain Franks asked. It means everything is as expected. No major news, Admiral Podolsky replied. Maxwell was catching a nap. Kaz wouldn't sleep until the mission was concluded. Our friend Clark even delivered it exactly on time. Colonel Glazoff didn't like working on weekends any more than his Western counterparts, even less so when it was because his administrative assistant had made a mistake and set this report on the wrong pile. At least the boy had admitted it and called his boss at home to report his error. He couldn't very well do much more than chide the oversight. At the same time, he had to praise the lad's honesty and sense of duty. He drove his personal car into Moscow from his dacha, found a parking place in the rear of the building, and submitted himself to the tiresome security clearance procedures before taking the elevator up. Then came the necessity of unlocking his office and sending for the right documents from Central Files, which also took longer than usual on this weekend day. All in all, just getting to the point at which he could examine the damn thing required 2 hours from the unwelcome phone call that had started the process. The colonel signed for the documents and watched the file clerk depart. "Bloody hell," the colonel said in English, finally alone in his fourth-floor office. Cassius had a friend in the White House National Security Office. No wonder some of his information had been so good. Good enough to force Georgi Borisovich to fly to London to consummate the recruitment. The senior KGB officer now had to chide himself. Cassius had kept that bit of information up his sleeve, perhaps in the knowledge that he'd rattle his ultimate control officer. The case officer, Captain Yegorov, had taken it in stride, as well he might, and described the first contact meeting in exquisite detail. "Boxwood Green," Glazoff said. Just a code name for the operation, selected for no particular reason, as the Americans did. The next question was whether or not to forward the data to the Vietnamese. That would be a political decision, and one to be made quickly. The colonel lifted the phone and dialed his most immediate superior, who was also at home and instantly in a foul humor. Sunrise was an equivocal thing. The color of the clouds changed from the gray of slate to the gray of smoke, as somewhere aloft the sun made its presence known, though that would not be the case here until the low-pressure area had passed north into China, or so the weather briefing had declared. Kelly checked his watch, making his mental notes at every point. The guard force was 44 men plus 4 officers, and maybe a cook or two. All except the 8 on tower duty formed up just after dawn for calisthenics. Many had trouble doing their morning exercises, and one of the officers, a senior lieutenant from his shoulder boards, hobbled around with a cane. Probably a bad arm, too, from the way he used it. "What got you?" Kelly wondered. A crippled and foul-tempered NCO walked the lines of soldiers, swearing at them in a way that showed long months of practice. Through his binoculars, Kelly watched the expressions that trailed behind the little bastard's back. It gave the NVA guards a human quality that he didn't welcome. Morning exercise lasted half an hour. When it ended, the soldiers headed off for morning chow, falling out in a decidedly casual and unmilitary way. The tower guards spent most of their time looking in, as expected, most often leaning on their elbows. Their weapons were probably not chambered, a sensible safety precaution that would count against them either this night or the next, depending on weather. Kelly made another check of his surroundings. It would not do for him to fix too closely on the objective. He wouldn't move about now, not even in the gray daylight that had come with the morning, but he could turn his head to look and listen. Catching the patterns of bird calls, getting used to it so that a change would register at once. He had a green cloth across the muzzle of his weapon, a floppy hat to break up the outline of his head within and behind the bush, and facial camouflage paint, all of which conspired to make him invisible, part of this warm, humid environment that... I mean, why do people fight for the damned place, he wondered. Already he could feel bugs on his skin. The worst of them were put off by the unscented repellent he'd spread around. But not all. And the feel of things crawling on him combined with the knowledge that he couldn't make any rapid moves. There were no small risks in a place like this. He'd forgotten so much. Training was good and valuable, but it never quite made it all the way to full preparation. There was no substitute for the actual dangers involved, the slightly increased heart rate that could tire you out even when you lay still. You never quite forgot it, but you never really remembered it all either. Food, nourishment, strength. He reached into a pocket, moving his hand slowly and withdrawing a pair of food bars. Nothing he'd eat by choice in any other place, but it was vital now. He tore off the plastic wrappers with his teeth and chewed them up slowly. The strength they imparted to his body was probably as much psychological as real, but both factors had their uses, as his body had to deal with both fatigue and stress. At 8, the guard cycle changed again. Those relieved from the towers went in for chow. Two men took posts at the gate, bored before they got there, looking out at the road for traffic that would probably never come to this backwater camp. Some work details formed, and the jobs they performed were as clearly useless to Kelly as to those who carried them out in a stoic, unhurried way. Colonel Grishinov arose just after 8. He'd been up late the night before, and though he'd planned to arise earlier, he'd just learned, to his displeasure, that his mechanical alarm clock had finally given up the ghost, corroded to death by the miserable climate. 8:10, he saw, looking at his aviator's watch. Damn, no morning run. It would soon be too hot for that, and besides, it looked like it would be raining all day. He brewed his own pot of tea over a small army-type cook stove. No morning paper to read, again. No news of the football scores. No review of a new ballet production. Nothing at all in this miserable place to distract him. Important as his duty was, he needed distraction as much as any man did. Not even decent plumbing. He was used to all of that, but it didn't help. God, to be able to go home, to hear people speaking his native language again, to be in a cultured place where there was something to talk about. Grishinov frowned in the shaving mirror. Months more to go, and he was grumbling like a private soldier, a damned recruit. He was supposed to know better. His uniform needed pressing. The humidity here attacked the cotton fibers, making his usually crisp blouse look like pajamas, and he was already on his third set of shoes, Grishinov thought, sipping now at his tea and going over notes from the previous night's interrogations. All work and no play, and he was already late. He tried to light a cigarette, but the humidity had also rendered his matches useless. Well, he had the cook stove for that. Where had he left his lighter? There were compensations, if you could call them that. The Vietnamese soldiers treated him with respect, almost awe, except for the camp commander, Major Vinh, worthless bastard that he was. Courtesy to a fellow socialist ally demanded that Grishinov be given an orderly, in this case a small, ignorant peasant boy with only one eye who was able to make the bed and carry out the slops bowl every morning. The colonel was able to walk out in the knowledge that his room would be somewhat tidy when he returned. And he had his work. Important. Professionally stimulating. but he would have killed for his morning Sovietsky sport.
"Good morning, Ivan," Kelly whispered to himself. He didn't even need the binoculars for that. The size was so different. The man was over 6 feet, and the uniform far neater than that worn by the NVA. The glasses showed Kelly the man's face, pale and florid, with a narrowed eye expression to contemplate the day. He made a gesture to a small private who'd been waiting outside the door of the officers' quarters. Orderly, Kelly thought. A visiting Russian colonel would like his comforts, wouldn't he? Definitely a pilot from the wings over the blouse pocket. Plenty of ribbons. Only one, Kelly wondered. Only one Russian officer to help torture the prisoners? Odd when you think about it. But that meant only one extraneous person to have to kill. And for all his lack of political sophistication, Kelly knew that killing Russians wouldn't do anyone much good. He watched the Russian walk across the parade ground. Then the senior visible Vietnamese officer, a major, went towards him. Another limper, Kelly saw. The little major saluted the tall colonel.
"Good morning, Comrade Colonel."
"Good morning, Major Vin." Little bastard can't even learn to salute properly. Perhaps he simply cannot make a proper gesture to his betters. "The rations for the prisoners?"
"They will have to be satisfied with what they have," the smaller man replied in badly accented and phrased Russian.
"Major, it is important that you understand me," Grishinov said, stepping closer so that he could look more sharply down at the Vietnamese. "I need the information they have. I cannot get it if they are too sick to speak."
"Tovarish, we have problems enough feeding our own people. You ask us to waste good food on murderers?"
The Vietnamese soldier responded quietly, using a tone that both conveyed his contempt for the foreigner and at the same time seemed respectful to his soldiers, who would not have understood exactly what this was all about. After all, they thought that the Russians were fast allies. "Your people do not have what my country needs, Major. And if my country gets what she needs, then your country might get more of what it needs. I have my orders. If you are experiencing difficulty in questioning the Americans, then I am prepared to help."
"Arrogant dog."
It was a suffix that didn't need to be spoken, and Vin knew how to stick his needle into a sensitive place. "Thank you, Major. That will not be necessary." Grishinov made a salute himself, even sloppier than that given him by this annoying little man. It would be good to watch him die, the Russian thought, walking off to the prison block. His first appointment of the day was with an American naval aviator who was just about ready to crack. Casual enough, Kelly thought, from several hundred yards away. Those two must get along fairly well. His scrutiny of the camp was relaxed now. His greatest fear was that the guard force might send out security patrols, as a line unit in hostile country would surely have done. But they were not in hostile territory, and this was not really a line unit. His next radio message to Ogden confirmed that everything was within acceptable risk limits. Sergeant Peter Meyer smoked. His father didn't approve, but accepted his son's weakness so long as he did it outside, as they were now, on the back porch of the parsonage after Sunday evening dinner. "It's Doris Brown, right?" Peter asked. At 26, he was one of his department's youngest sergeants, and like most of the current class of police officers, a Vietnam veteran. He was within 6 credit hours of completing his night school degree, and was considering making an application to the FBI Academy. Word that the wayward girl had returned was now circulating through the neighborhood. "I remember her. She had a reputation as a hot number a few years back." "Peter, you know I can't say. This is a pastoral matter. I will counsel the person to speak to you when the time is right, but..." "Pop, I understand the law on that, okay? You have to understand we're talking 2 homicides here. 2 dead people, plus the drug business." He flipped the butt of his Salem into the grass. "That's pretty heavy stuff, Pop." "Even worse than that," his father reported more quietly still.
They don't just kill the girls. Torture. Sexual abuse. It's pretty horrible.